The corner of 12th and Arch Street in Philadelphia, right by the Reading Terminal Market, is always busy with buses, shoppers, and tourists. 20 years ago, Tom Hanks pulled up right here in a cab.
Andy.
He was shooting a scene for the movie Philadelphia. The film would go on to fundamentally change the national conversation about HIV and AIDS.
20 years ago, it definitely provided an opportunity to have a conversation about HIV. It affirmed people who were positive and people who were unsure about how to support people who were positive.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. The Pulse takes you inside brightly lit laboratories and sometimes dark basements to learn about new scientific discoveries. We walk down the halls of busy hospitals to hear patient stories or to find out what their doctors are feeling.
Innovation drives the creative economy.
It is the cutting edge of what modern neuroscience can do.
Brain injury survivors still are capable of doing many things.
I think there's a notion that researchers are in some sort of ivory tower.
This is my health.
We're not just a body, we're not just a head.
Robots are really just computers with motors.
The speed at which they can process information, their ability to filter out.
In addition to your knee pain, you're also dealing with insomnia.
On today's show, what's eating evergreen trees in our region? It's a tiny, fuzzy creature, and you can play a role in defeating it. Later, we'll tour Philadelphia with a man who gets around on sounds alone. Every click of his tongue delivers a tiny piece of information. And we find out that the way to break your Italian grandmother's heart is through your stomach. But first, back to Philadelphia, the film, which debuted in theaters 20 years ago this week and went on to win 2 Oscars. Philadelphia, the city, played a major role in the film's success as a setting and as a source of material and authenticity. This is a rich story that we didn't want to shortchange, so we're going to tell it in 2 parts. Later on the show, we'll explore what HIV/AIDS looks like in Philadelphia now, but first, reporter Alana Gordon takes us back 20 years to the making of the film and its immediate impact.
The year is 1993. The Phillies have just won the National League pennant. Rich Kotite is coaching the Eagles. Ed Rendell's mayor. The Pennsylvania Convention Center has just opened. And hundreds of thousands of moviegoers are about to meet Andrew Beckett.
Granting a restraining order against this construction site will throw 753 Philadelphians out of work and lend validation to the...
Beckett, played by Tom Hanks, is a bright young lawyer at a high-profile law firm in the film Philadelphia.
Stop nuts, Mr. Beckett.
Thanks, Kenneth. Robert.
Hi, Mr. Beckett.
Hi, Rose. Anthea. Just
Beckett is gay and has HIV. But his firm fires him when it figures those 2 facts out. Beckett wants to sue, but has trouble finding a lawyer to take his case.
You want to sue Wyatt, Wheeler, Hellman, Tetlow, and Brown?
Correct. I'm seeking representation.
He ends up with a young attorney, Joe Miller, played by Denzel Washington.
How many lawyers you go to before you call me?
9.
What follows is a powerful tale of Beckett's legal, medical, and emotional journey. He wins the case, but loses his life.
I remember there was quite a buzz about it.
Gary Bell is director of Babashi, a longtime health agency in Philadelphia with a special focus on serving people of color with HIV.
And I think the good news is that it got people talking about HIV in a way that they really weren't, because HIV was always the thing we didn't really want to talk about.
This was major.
Marla Gold is a former assistant city health commissioner, HIV doctor, and public health dean at Drexel.
We have a major star playing this significant role, acted out beautifully as a movie that's award-winning. So this is a lot different than a pamphlet that arrives in the mail and warns you of something. This is real.
HIV is a virus that can wreak havoc on a person's immune system. By 1993, when the film came out, AIDS had killed more than 200,000 Americans.
We got together and tried to come up with a movie that would help push for a cure and save lives.
Jonathan Demme, fresh off winning a Best Picture Oscar for Silence of the Lambs, directed and produced Philadelphia. He and others involved had dear friends dying of AIDS at the time. Demme says the challenge was creating a story that could transcend the huge stigma AIDS carried and pull in the general public.
And we didn't want to make a film that would appeal to an audience of people like us who already had a predisposition to caring about people with AIDS. We wanted to reach the people who couldn't care less about people with AIDS. That was our target audience.
So Demme offered roles to two of Hollywood's most bankable stars, Hanks and Washington. He brought in big rock stars like The Boss, Bruce Springsteen, for music. Why Philadelphia? Well, it was cheaper to film here. It was the city where Jefferson wrote, "All men are created equal." And it gave Demme plenty of backdrops that he says portrayed both the diversity and the grittiness of real America. Again, Marla Gold.
You know, it's a fantastic city, and it took it into the homes of Americans and said it can happen here. And it also said, if it can happen here, it can happen in your city, and it is happening in your city.
Philadelphia was fitting in other ways. It was an early center of AIDS activism and even had an AIDS office that reported directly to the mayor. Researchers around here would contribute to advances in understanding and treating the disease.
Tell you all about our fee arrangement. Of course, you know we take no cash unless we get cash justice
for you. For Gary Bell, part of the film's appeal hinged on the Joe Miller character, the lawyer played by Denzel Washington, who was hesitant to take on Beckett's case at first because of his sexual orientation and his HIV status.
You know, he was a hustler. He was a guy trying to make a living any way he could, and he gave voice to the fear and the stigma and all the things that were holding people back from getting involved in this or learning more about it.
Would you accept a client if you were constantly thinking, I don't want this person to touch me, I don't want them to even breathe on me?
Not if I was you, honey.
That's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm.
Bell says that as Miller got to know Beckett, he transformed, and so too did viewers.
It was realistic. I think he was realistic.
The HIV virus can only be transmitted through the exchange of bodily fluids, namely blood, semen, and vaginal secretions.
Right.
Philadelphia wasn't just made in Philadelphia. The film was made with the people of Philadelphia, too. Here's Demme.
I wanted very, very much to employ people with AIDS as extras or any other aspect, because it was very, very hard for people with AIDS 20 years ago to get jobs and what have you.
The local service agency Action AIDS played a big role in this.
So
we're at 1216 Arch Street in front of the Action AIDS offices, across the street from the convention center now. When the movie was made, that was a big hole in the ground.
Inés Luttrell was director of Action AIDS at the time of the movie. Kevin Burns was with the agency too, and is now its current director. In the film, their office became a clinic. Hank's character walks in to see his doctor and stays for an IV treatment.
Andy, I just don't get it.
Hi, Doc.
Your blood work came back this morning. I'm going to come back in a few minutes and talk to you about it. All right?
I'll be right here.
Good. I remember passing him as he was going back to make up, or, you know, he was walking across the hall, and I said something like, thank you very much, and he said, no, thank you.
Patience, Tyrone. Okay.
Action AIDS also helped to coordinate the casting of several dozen Philadelphians who were HIV positive.
There was a bunch of people, HIV positive, standing in line, all wanting to be a part of the movie. Jonathan Demme himself later just went down the line of people that were wanting to be extras who are HIV positive and just said, okay, you come here, you come here.
Sue Ellen Kaler was one of them. Like the Andy Beckett character, she grew up in Lower Merion on the Main Line.
We would all sit around saying we've got to do whatever is necessary to stay, you know, stay alive so that when they do discover that breakthrough pill, we'll be alive.
About 50 extras in the film had HIV, some with visible signs of the disease in that clinic scene. But within a year of the film's release, most had died. Kevin Burns, again with Action AIDS, says that aspect brings an added weight and pride to the film.
For them, it wasn't a movie. For them, this was how they lived their lives, with courage and great grace. And that wasn't lost on them, I think, being in the movie. I think for many of them, they got some peace and some sense of accomplishment that their struggle was being documented.
Tom Hanks, during his Oscar acceptance speech for his role in the film.
I know that my work in this case is magnified by the fact that the streets of heaven are too crowded with angels. We know their names. They number 1,000 for each one of the red ribbons that we wear here tonight. They finally rest.
I personally could not see the movie. I felt like we were living it day and night. I didn't want to see another patient die.
Dr. Michael Braffman was an infectious disease doctor in 1993, and still is, at Pennsylvania Hospital.
Here's my patient list. I mean, here's my long list of people who died.
Sitting inside the hospital's original medical library, he goes through several sheets of paper with handwritten names on them.
When they died, what they died of.
So that's about, what, like 100 names?
I counted it up once. There were about 154 names.
By 1993, nearly 3,000 Philadelphians had died of AIDS, according to one news report. Braffman says the film was hard to watch for another reason. That discrimination Beckett faced was a real fear for his patients. Philadelphia had several high-profile AIDS discrimination suits, some of which mirrored the film's plot. Braffman had to go to court and testify in one of his patients' cases, who, like Beckett, was a lawyer.
One of his employers came and was hounding him and me and everybody in the hospital about when's he coming out of from work, what's going on, and we just sort of had to politely say, you know, he's sick, we're going to get him better, but really I'm not sure you're the right person to talk to. Before he left the hospital, he was fired, or at least let go.
In the credits to the film Philadelphia, it says the script was partly inspired by a similar case in New York. But there was another case that got even more attention here.
The night the movie Philadelphia becomes a real-life drama for this local lawyer.
Jury selection began in federal court in Center City today in a case that parallels the movie Philadelphia.
Scott had worked for a very well-known and nationally known law firm here in town.
Alan Epstein represented Scott Burr. His case started before the film was shot, but went to trial after. During jury selection, anyone who'd seen the film was out. Epstein says those selected had one thing in common.
Every juror on that jury panel, except for one, had stated that they were afraid of casual contact with people who had AIDS.
Before the film's release, the Americans with Disabilities Act passed. The law strengthened protections for people with HIV. It was used in Scott Burr's case, as well as countless others that would follow. But Epstein says the case wasn't just about HIV. It was about the stigma it carried, its association as a gay men's disease. That was also a reality emphasized in the film. Here's Denzel Washington's character speaking to the courtroom during Beckett's trial.
Because this case is not just about AIDS, is it? So let's talk about what this case is really all about. The general public's hatred, our loathing, our fear of homosexuals.
Epstein says during Burr's trial, he saw some people go through the kind of transformation Denzel Washington's character and others went through in the film.
And once we educated people as to who he was and what it was like being a person with AIDS, there was a changing of attitudes to the extent that I think it was 9 people came down and actually hugged and kissed Scott at the conclusion of the case.
Epstein, who's still practicing employment law today, is struck by the shift in attitudes and changes that have taken place since the trial and the film. Not only that, but unlike Beckett, Scott Burr is alive and well today. He's still a lawyer. Dr. Braffman, the local HIV doctor, says the film Philadelphia came out right on the eve of a new era for HIV, giving hope to Sue Ellen Keeler, that extra in the film, and others.
1993 was a long time ago. In HIV, it was an eon ago.
But even with the major changes to come, many think the film still resonates in a lot of ways today. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
That's part one of our report on the movie Philadelphia. Elana Gordon will be back later on the show to tell us about the people who are working hard in 2013 to write a new script for HIV/AIDS in Philadelphia. We also have a lot of information on our website and photos of many of the people in Elana's report, whyy.org/thepulse. Coming up next on The Pulse, navigating through Philadelphia with a series of tongue clicks.
By making a simple tongue click, I can actually see visual forms around me, seeing through sound instead of seeing through light.
It's hard to imagine, but stay tuned. It's next on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca is focused on the discovery and development of prescription medicines to treat some of the world's most serious diseases. With its U.S. headquarters in Wilmington, Delaware, AstraZeneca operates in more than 100 countries, and its medicines are used by millions of patients worldwide. More at AstraZeneca-US.com or at the company's blog at azhealthconnections.com. AstraZeneca proudly supports WHYY's The Pulse.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, our favorite choral director with his choices for classical Christmas music, everything from Bach to the most beloved French carol. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Think about your daily routine. Getting up, getting dressed, getting around town. You probably take it for granted, but imagine doing all those tasks without using your sight. Zach Seward has this day in the life portrait of a Philadelphia man who sees things differently.
My day starts with my cat wanting food and water, so I get that for her. And there's a sound every cat and cat owner knows, opening a can of Fancy Feast. And now she's purring because she's a good girl.
Aww. No big deal, right? But for Austin Serafin, who's been blind his whole life, simple tasks can sometimes be a challenge.
So now that I've made her breakfast, I can make myself breakfast.
Serafin is from Swarthmore, but he lives in the city now. He's an accessibility consultant by day, a volunteer touch tour docent at the Penn Museum, and a computer programmer who's been coding since he was 7.
I use a screen reader. My computer talks to me.
475 messages, 5 unread, window, mail activity, Adam Tedris, Ignite Talk, 10/23/13.
Catch that? Me neither. Here it is slowed down.
Inbox, 475 messages, 5 unread, window, mail activity, Adam Tedris, Ignite Talk, 10/23/13, attachment image, just some ideas.
And it always makes me laugh when sighted people ask if I can really understand it that fast.
I first heard Austin talk on stage at an event last month called Ignite Philly. It's these lightning talks by local people doing interesting things. I was blown away by Austin's talk, so we got him to come into the studio, and I got to ask him some questions.
Crossing at S3rd Street.
But first, let's take a ride with the car service Uber and a special GPS app over to the Old City co-working space called Indy Hall. Austin recorded the sound himself.
Sounds like we might have passed it. Anything can happen when you have a disability.
You arrived at Indy Hall.
So now I'm standing outside of Indy Hall, smoking my pipe. I know I'm here because of the door and the window. I recognize that. So now let's take a little walk around the city. There's my cane hitting a leaf.
Every little click you're hearing is a tiny piece of information. The cane is something that most blind people use, but Serafin also uses a technique that's a little bit under the radar.
So to get around, I use a cane for short-range vision, and I use echolocation for long-range vision. By making a simple tongue click, I can actually see visual forms around me, seeing through sound instead of seeing through light. You can also get that through other sounds like the cane, passively. For instance, you can tell we're passing an alcove. You can hear that echo.
So, Austin, the first thing that I am most curious about is this concept of echolocation. First of all, how does it work? What are you seeing right now?
Okay, so echolocation works by using reflected sound instead of through reflected light. By making a simple tongue click like what I just did, you can actually train your brain to decode the binaural echoes coming back from that as visual inputs. So what you see is they're like mannequins, like dark forms. And that's, of course, because sound travels slower than light.
Austin is relatively new to echolocation. The technique is only taught by one organization in the whole world, called World Access for the Blind. Serafin says it's something you can teach yourself if you're ready to stretch different parts of your brain.
Just start with some obvious things like a plate and a pillow, for instance. They're two very different surfaces. And then you kind of build it from there, and you've got to build up this kind of library of images in your mind. It actually, for me, being blind from birth, I had to actually learn to think like a sighted person. So that's a whole process. So I started doing, you know, those things around the house, and then I decided, okay, it's time for the 3-day intensive. And I asked him repeatedly, I was like, can you really teach me to do this effectively in 3 days? And he assured me he could, and he came, and I underwent the intensive, and sure enough, he taught me the basics. But you can get really good.
That's cool. So you've only been doing it for about a year and a half, you said?
Yeah.
Huh.
My teacher's been doing it for 10 years, so he's really good. They go mountain biking and crazy things like that.
So Austin came to this new way of seeing fairly late in life. He's 36 now, and he says it's revolutionized the way he interacts with the outside world.
With just a cane, you memorize turns, and you say, okay, take the second turn or whatever. But with echolocation, you're building visual maps of spaces in your head, just like a sighted person would. So it's changing the way you're doing everything. It makes it easier, little things, even like making eye contact with someone, because you'll see them there. So Philly has a lot of sounds, a lot of cars, trucks, trains, buses, sirens, people walking and talking. Philly has a lot of smells, some good, like shops and restaurants. Some not so good, like sewer grates and car exhaust.
Austin says the city has a feeling, and it's generally getting better. And seeing through sound is giving him a new way to interact with it. Back in the studio, he uses echolocation to check out our setup.
So right now, even just from the sound of my voice, although I'm not, with headphones on, it's kind of difficult. Here we go. With the sound of my voice, I can even see that there's a microphone kind of in front of me just from that. And then doing a tongue click, I can kind of get its shape in a teeny bit more detail, kind of see that it's kind of sticking out a little, and there's some, like, wiry things behind it. When I come home, I might like to watch some television, but for me, television means listening to the audio and using my imagination. When sighted people watch TV, they don't use their imagination. They don't see things in their heads. The moving video keeps them from doing that. And that kind of concerns me. And so I recommend that everyone spend some time every day. I recommend that you turn on your inner vision. Sit with your spine straight, make your breath silent, and put your attention on the space between your eyes. And enjoy the silence.
I was struck during your Ignite Philly talk about the participatory element. You have this crowd full of beer-drinking people at Johnny Brenda's, and you get up on stage and ask them to close their eyes and experience for 5 minutes what you experience every day.
Yeah.
Do you wish more people had a chance to do that?
You know, that's kind of the point, to you kind of use all your senses, you know? There's so much to take in using all of your senses, and we're definitely in a very visual centered culture. You know, that's why I'm really trying to speak a lot about accessibility and get into the whole civic engagement things and help make things more accessible. Because, like I said, accessibility helps everyone.
Austin Serafin is an accessibility consultant and a jack of many trades. For the full 5-minute trip through being blind in Philly and a companion video, head to our website, whyy.org/thepulse. I'm Zach Seward.
And now, time for your stories of illness, recovery, and coping in our regular segment, Patient Files. This week, what happens when you're Italian, but a medical issue forces you to reject most of your culinary heritage?
I'm Valerie DeMambro. I live in Philadelphia in Queens Village. I am a stand-up comedian and storyteller in the city of Philadelphia. Oh my god, ricotta cheese pie, that's like the best thing in the world, but I definitely can't eat that anymore because the crust is like the best part of that. This is probably like a tiramisu or something, I guess, right? Do you guys have any gluten-free offerings?
Not at all.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Thank you.
Where I moved from New York to Philadelphia in 2010, it was a super stressful time in my life. I was married for 2 years, and my husband at the time had spent most of my money. So I was broke. I filed for divorce, was laid off from my job, and found bed bugs. All within a 3-week period of time. So all signs were pointing to I needed to move back home with my parents, according to my mother. But I started having extreme stomach issues. Not only that, I was extremely lethargic. I was waking up with numbness in my arms and legs, and I started to gain weight. And I didn't know why, because I'd been exercising a lot more. So the conversation kind of went like this. The doctor was like, hey, Val, how long has your stomach been hurting you? And I was like, well, doc, 9, maybe 10 years. So he just kind of looked at me and decided to run some tests. And about a week later, I got the diagnosis, and it was celiac. And I was all like, silly who? Because I'd never heard of this before. I had no idea what he was talking about. Apparently, at some point in my life, and mostly because of the stress of the prior 6 months, because that's what happens with celiac, I became intolerant of gluten. I was diagnosed a wheat racist, which was a very weird moment in my life. I'm Italian-American. I grew up Italian-American. So I was raised on a steady diet of things like pasta, bread, chicken, breaded fried cheese, breaded fried vegetables, cannolis, The Godfather, Mario Lanza, and a healthy side of guilt. That was basically what my life was like. So being gluten-free meant being gone of all of the delicious things on that list. I was basically ignoring Clemenza's advice from The Godfather. I was taking the gun but leaving the cannolis. So it made no sense. My grandmother would just look at me with disappointment and threaten me with guilt and just like, just eat the macaronis, I could be dead tomorrow. And I'm not saying that my refusal of gluten's killed my grandmother. I'm only saying that she just happened to die 1 month after I told her I could no longer eat her raviolis. I just turned into a completely different person. I no longer, had comfort foods. I'd be freaking out and I couldn't even have like macaroni and cheese. The only thing that this restaurant would have for me is a freaking salad. And if they brought it with a crouton on it, I was literally going to explode in the middle of the restaurant.
My name is Brett Hopkins. I'm working at the Flying Monkey Bakery in the Reading Terminal in Center City, Philadelphia. I try to keep everything listed as gluten-free items. We can't call them gluten-free because we're open-aired, so we make everything noticed as flour-free because we don't put any flour in the production of the products.
What would you recommend?
Our flourless macaroon, which is on the other side behind me, has coconut, egg whites, sugar, and almond extracts. The flourless chocolate cake is chocolate, butter, eggs, sugar, cornstarch, salts.
Yeah, I am going to get a macaroon.
Total is 125.
Thank
out
you.
Of two.
When the moon hits your eye like a bigger pizza pie.
I guess I'm free from gluten, but it feels more like free from flavor, free from joy. I get it. It's also free from pooping in my pants. But, that seems like a really small price to pay for a really good slice of pizza.
Valerie DeMambro is a Philadelphia comedian and storyteller, and she was diagnosed with celiac disease a few years ago. Sophie Reed produced this story. Do you have a story you want to share with us for Patient Files? Email us at thepulse@whyy.org. Now, this whole gluten-free thing, it's everywhere, isn't it?
It has been sort of a fad that's blown up bigger than a lot of fad diets that we've seen.
Dr. Stephanie Molesky is a gastroenterologist at Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia. She says in addition to celiac disease, which is an autoimmune disorder, there's also gluten sensitivity.
patients ingest gluten and may have similar symptoms, GI symptoms, gas, bloating, diarrhea. They might have fatigue. And, you know, initially as physicians, we thought, oh, these patients don't have celiac disease. You know, they want to have celiac disease, but they really don't. And at first it was sort of, you know, disregarded as not being really a real entity. And more recently, over the past couple of years, there's been more research on the area.
Some people also have wheat allergies and get hives or suffer shortness of breath. And if you want to cut out gluten because you think you feel better without it, here's some advice.
It's expensive. We want to make sure that if you're going to do it, that you do it in a healthful manner so that you read your labels, make sure you're getting the same, you know, amount of enriched foods that you were eating before, and that you watch the calories and make sure that we don't have weight gain. I mean, I talk to people about it all day, and I don't avoid gluten.
Dr. Stephanie Molesky is a gastroenterologist at Jefferson University Hospital. Coming up next on The Pulse, what's attacking our Christmas trees? The creature has a cute name, but it's fierce. That's next on The Pulse.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Yes, I've got heartaches by the number.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our 1999 interview with country singer Ray Price, who died Monday at the age of 87. His hits included Crazy Arms and Heartaches by the Number. He was Hank Williams' roommate. Willie Nelson and Roger Miller played in Price's band. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Home for the holidays, what are your college kids not telling you?
I was on the ledge of a windowsill, thinking to myself, just let go, aim for the metal hut, head first.
Pressure and isolation of college, it's a serious health problem. What's being done about it? People making a difference next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca is a global biopharmaceutical business focused on the discovery and development of prescription medicines to treat the world's most serious diseases. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. We'd love to know what you think of the show. You can tell us by tweeting at WHYYThePulse or post a comment on our website at WHYY.org/ThePulse. That's also where you can find all of the stories from today's show. You don't need a lab coat or a science degree to participate in groundbreaking research happening in our region. All it takes is a computer, a sense of curiosity, and a passion for science. Joining us now is Darlene Cavalier. She has a website called SciStarter. Darlene, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Darlene, what is SciStarter?
SciStarter is a website that connects regular people to real science projects they can do.
For example,
we have more than 600 active projects in our database right now, ranging from monitoring the migratory path of butterflies and birds and bees to collecting information about snow depth measurements.
So what does that entail for people who participate?
For the serious citizen scientist, it can entail doing do-it-yourself bioengineering in your home. And for the less advanced or ambitious citizen scientists, it might be as easy as sticking a ruler in the snow in your backyard and helping scientists better understand the depths near you.
So for the scientists who are overseeing these studies, collecting the data, how do they know that what they are getting is good stuff?
It's a numbers game. So the more people that are involved in these projects and submitting data, the more likely it is to be able to look for patterns. The stuff that doesn't look real is on the fringes and kind of gets discounted. There are other projects that require training of the volunteers to come out, a physical face-to-face interaction with the researcher, and they do the project together.
Is this a popular option with scientists who are doing studies?
By way of one example, there were fewer than 50 citizen science citations in peer-reviewed journals in 2009 to nearly 600 in 2013.
Wow, so that number has really shot up.
Big time.
And I would think this is a good activity for families a lot of times.
It's a great activity for families. I myself organized the Firefly Watch project with my family for 15 minutes an evening on any given summer week. You sit with your family and you count fireflies. And in the process of enrolling in that project, you learn what the difference between a male and a female firefly. And more importantly, you start to understand the ecological importance of this species.
So if I want to find a project that I can participate in, where do I go?
You go to scistarter.com. You can search for projects by activity, and you can search for project by topic. For example, one project that we're organizing right now is to activate 4,000 people to collect microbes from shoes and cell phones, as well as from surface areas. 4 lucky samples will be heading to the International Space Station at the end of February for a growth rate analysis to see how microbes react differently in a near-zero G environment versus here on Earth.
So from my shoe to space, perhaps?
Pretty much.
Darlene Cavalier, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to keep track of projects on the SciStarter website regularly here on The Pulse. And today we actually have our first installment in the Citizen Science series, What's Eating Our Evergreen Trees? Here's Pulse contributor Kimberly Haas.
The balsam fir, a tree now starring in many homes as the centerpiece of Christmas decorations, has a tiny enemy in the wild. So does the hemlock, the Pennsylvania state tree. Their nemesis is a little sucker, literally, an insect called the woolly adelgid. Jason Lubar is an arborist at Penn's Morris Arboretum.
The hemlock woolly adelgid has a piercing, sucking mouthpart like a straw and sucks out the plant's juices.
You can do something to help these evergreens survive. A group of scientists called the Alliance for Saving Threatened Forests is enlisting volunteer tree spotters. The goal is to identify hemlocks and balsam firs that are healthy, even though surrounding trees are succumbing to the woolly adelgids.
We're hoping that we can find some natural resistance within our native population.
Fred Hain is a forest entomologist with the Alliance.
We're interested in trying to breed trees that have resistance to exotic forest pests. And so we're looking for trees that are still alive. They may be infested, but as long as they look fairly healthy with a good crown color and a fairly dense crown, that suggests to us that they may, in fact, be resistant.
So that's the job for citizen scientists willing to tromp through the woods, spot a healthy tree, record its location, and register it on the project website. In this area, volunteer tree spotters will be focusing on the hemlock, which is native to the region and grows plentifully. So say you're out hunting hemlocks for the project. You can recognize them by their short, flat needles and scaly brown bark. Their oval cones are small, only about an inch long. Jason Lubar has some tips on where to spot hemlocks in our area, such as Fairmount Park.
Oh, the Wissahickon is a great place to go, especially in the winter time, because the hemlocks are an evergreen plant. They'll stand out readily from the other deciduous plants, deciduous meaning trees that lose their leaves. So basically, it'll be either a white pine or a hemlock.
Hemlocks along the Wissahickon Creek have been pretty hard hit by woolly adelgids, Lubar said. He added that you might find hemlocks closer to home, too, since they're planted readily by the landscaping industry. When you see some, take a closer look at their branches.
And if you turn over the leaves of a hemlock, and with hemlocks they almost look like needles, but they're very small leaves. And the woolly adelgid typically looks like a woolly, hence its name, a woolly mass on the underside of the leaf. You probably will need glasses or a magnifying lens to really take a good look at these insects.
So if you find some hemlocks standing strong amid others that the insects have attacked, mark down the location and approximate height and diameter of the healthy tree. Then, Fred Hain says, go to the website threatenedforest.com to enter the data.
There's a Google map there, and they can pinpoint exactly where they are and hit submit, and it'll come directly to us. And then we'll either go there ourselves or we'll contact somebody in the area that'll go and examine the tree for us.
To help you in your search, you can see pictures of hemlocks and the hemlock woolly adelgid at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. You can get more information on this and other opportunities for citizen science at the website SciStarter.com. For The Pulse, I'm Kimberly Haas.
Today on The Pulse, we've been taking a closer look at the film Philadelphia, which came out 20 years ago.
It's hard to believe that it's been that long.
And then you start thinking about all the things that have changed in those 20 years.
1993 was a long time ago. In HIV, it was an eon ago.
And yet there are some 50,000 plus new infections a year in this country, despite what we know.
Earlier on the show, The Pulse's Elana Gordon took us back to 1993. We heard how the making of the film affected Philadelphians who had AIDS and those who cared for them. We met Sue Ellen Kaler, an HIV patient who was an extra in the film.
There was a bunch of people, HIV positive, standing in line, all wanting to be a part of the movie.
In the 20 years since the film's release, Kaler and others have been shaping a new script for HIV and Philadelphia. Elana Gordon picks things up from here.
Sue Ellen Kaler is a petite woman. You can catch her sitting in the courtroom right behind Denzel Washington and Tom Hanks at City Hall as an extra in the movie.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury.
The whole truth and nothing but the truth to help you, God.
His
I do.
Lawyers
please be seated.
Discovered his illness. And ladies and gentlemen, the illness.
Are you a good lawyer?
I'm an excellent lawyer.
They panicked.
Damages we award $4,782,000.
But while Hank's character's health deteriorates on screen, Kaler and others were facing that situation in real life as they hoped for a breakthrough in treatment.
You know, I thought when I was diagnosed that I would be dead in a few years.
Most HIV positive extras died within a year of the movie's release. Not Kaler, who, 20 years later, is thought by many to be the only one still living.
There's so many. Just start.
In the bedroom of her Northeast Philadelphia home, Kaler points to her nightstand, and more specifically, to what she calls her lifeline.
Some of them I take 4 days.
About a dozen pill bottles.
6 days.
Her room is sparse, with just one frame on the wall. It's a photo of her on a magazine cover, with the headline, Soul Survivor.
And I look at that and I remember, if I want to be around another 20 years, I need to make sure that these pills go down, even if I have to force them down one at a time, because my friends didn't make it. So these pills are something that they wish they could have made it for.
Kaler recently celebrated her 50th birthday. She's grateful, upbeat even. For her, the film Philadelphia was a starting point in overcoming the emotional weight of her diagnosis and in helping cope with the loss of her friends. She says she's now living another chapter about what it's like living as long as she has with HIV.
Where are they going?
Kaler attributes her longevity to her two kids. Okay, they're dogs, Pomeranians, her best friend Hilda, and her religion.
Yes, medicine is very important, but I state wholeheartedly that you must have faith in something.
But in her condition, fatigue and side effects are also constant companions.
For me, if I do laundry and will fold my clothes, that is a lot for me.
Kaler says, no doubt, life today is less isolated for her and others with HIV. She credits the film for some of that. After the film came out, a coworker who'd moved her desk away pushed it closer again. Yet, Kaler says she's reminded almost daily that the stigma is still out there.
I personally see for myself that a lot has not changed.
For example, some neighbors won't let their kids near her house. Last year, when she was hospitalized, she says staff wouldn't touch her skin.
This is the essence of discrimination. Formulating opinions about others not based on their individual merits, but rather on their membership in a group with assumed characteristics.
When the movie Philadelphia came out, we all thought it was this groundbreaker. And there was this prevailing thought, like, wow, there's a movie from a big studio that says it's wrong to discriminate against people with AIDS. This is it. This is going to make all the difference. We won't see these cases.
Rhonda Goldfein is director of the AIDS Law Project of Pennsylvania, based here in Philadelphia. She says these days, the Andrew Beckett character in the film wouldn't have any trouble finding a lawyer to take his case. The Americans with Disabilities Act, passed in 1990, now gives clear legal backing to the kind of suit Beckett brought. The city also has its own laws to strengthen workplace protections for people who are gay. Even so,
we still get 3 to 5 calls a week that somebody's been treated differently simply because they have a virus, that they can't get health care because the doctor is afraid of them or the receptionist is afraid of them, that the kids in the neighborhood won't play with their kids. We're representing a woman right now who was fired because her employer told her that nobody would touch money after she touched it. I mean, this stuff is still happening all the time.
One thing that's not happening a lot around here is people dying of AIDS. In 1993, when audiences first learned the Andrew Beckett character in the film Philadelphia had AIDS, they could conclude he would die by the film's end. Dr. Michael Braffman, a longtime HIV doctor at Pennsylvania Hospital, used to keep a handwritten memorial list of all the patients he'd lost. But he stopped doing that.
All of a sudden, by the mid-90s, people stopped dying. The home care companies said, "How come you're not sending us patients anymore?" And we said, "We have no more patients to send you. They're actually living."
Braffman says that's thanks to major improvements in antiretroviral treatments.
The difference between 1993 and 2013 is indescribable. To see that in the arc of a career is more than remarkable. We almost never lose patients. They die of heart attacks, they die of cancer, they die of auto accidents, they die of old age. They're just not dying the way they did.
The relentless efforts of AIDS activists and federal and private support for HIV have also made it easier for people to get medicine and live normal, long lives. Investment in HIV research has also grown, with area institutions working to advance understandings of the disease. Earlier this month, efforts aimed at finding a cure got a federal funding boost. Scientists have also learned more about HIV transmission. Preventing mother-to-child cases is one big success. Yet, the disease is still spreading.
It's just a consent form. Just let you know that we're doing the testing.
Boston Canary is a local prevention specialist. On a recent weekend, he was out at a community center in South Philadelphia. He hands a woman a popsicle-sized paddle. She rubs it in her mouth for a saliva sample. And Canary then drops it in a small tube.
I'm doing a rapid HIV test. It takes about 20 minutes to get your results.
Canary, who's 36, was diagnosed with HIV in April 2005. He says his own partner had it and hadn't told him.
When I got tested, I was very scared. And when I had a positive result, it was very hard for me.
But he says by maintaining a healthy lifestyle and keeping up with his meds, he's living essentially a normal life. So now he's trying to help others.
There's a lot of people that really don't know they have this epidemic, and we're hoping that we can find positive people so we can link them to care and give them medicine so we can live longer.
Here in Philadelphia, the rates of new HIV infections are 3 times the national average, with roughly 700 to 800 newly reported cases in the city each year. Headway has been made. A long-standing needle exchange has been credited for curbing HIV infections among people who inject drugs. But Canary says, along with fear, he's fighting a lot of misinformation, especially among young adults, about how you can get the virus.
You hear the little sounds, "Oh my God, he has AIDS, I don't want to be touched." And I keep telling them, there's 4 ways you can come in contact with HIV. And they're like, "Not by hugging, no."
Canary spends a lot of time in neighborhoods, passing out condoms. He says encouraging HIV testing is a hard sell. It worries Gary Bell, a longtime HIV advocate and director of Babashi, a healthcare agency in Philly where Canary works. Bell says even educated, smart people he knows think the disease is tamed, pointing to things like the continued good health of basketball legend Magic Johnson.
The problem is that up to 75% of people who are HIV positive are not getting the right level of care, meaning they either don't know they're positive, they're in and out of care, or they're just not getting the kind of quality care that keeps their viral load down.
HIV is also a disease that stalks the poor. Kevin Burns sees that on a regular basis as director of Action AIDS, an agency involved in the making of the film Philadelphia. Burns says the virus may just pile up on top of other challenges people face daily, like finding a stable place to live.
The reality today is that housing is treatment, because they can't access treatment and have the treatment be effective if they're homeless.
So if I have on my medical hat as a physician, the advances medically since the movie aired are astounding.
Marla Gold is a former deputy health commissioner for the city and a professor at Drexel School of Public Health. She says despite the progress, even if a cure for AIDS were found, the health system would struggle to get it to everyone who needed it.
So we have to ask ourselves, why can't we get through that last hoop to prevent this disease?
But the contrast between the 1993 Philadelphia, shown in Jonathan Demme's film, and the Philadelphia of today offers some activists grounds for hope. 25-year-old Rafael Alvarez has taken part in a city-backed effort to spread HIV awareness to the Latino community, where infection rates remain worrisome. Alvarez also says the aim is to push back against the notion that the community rejects people who are gay.
Perceptions are reality, and if the perception of a community is, you know, negative or, you know, is labeled in ignorance, then that's what's going to be the reality.
Alvarez recently watched the film Philadelphia again and says it was still moving. It also reminded him of his own family struggles with a great aunt who died of AIDS in the 90s. He wasn't allowed to see her. Watching the film, Alvarez says he's struck by how Hank's character is portrayed as a real person with friends and family who loved him.
He's not AIDS, he's a person, and that gave him his humanity back. And I think that is the lasting impact.
Today, Alvarez views his work and that of others as picking up where the film left off.
It was definitely put into perspective why we have to fight and change. Because you know something, the work that we have done, we have changed HIV. Like, we genuinely have done that. But there's so much work to be done. And that's what it affirmed for me, the movie.
For Sue Ellen Kaler, the HIV-positive extra in the film Philadelphia, her life is also one of hope, as she spends her days writing and documenting her own story as a follow-up to the film. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
And that's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Jeanette Woods produced segments for today's show. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our assistant producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Elizabeth Perez-Luna directed today's show. Chris Satullo is our vice president of news. And Christine Dempsey is our chief content officer. And you? Well, we'd really love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.